Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, our weekly show about gay life from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. During the AIDS epidemic, San Francisco lost more than 19,000 people, mostly gay men. Another 19,000 are estimated to have HIV here in the city. It was a crisis. For the last 10 years or so, San Francisco has faced what's been called a second epidemic. Recreational drugs have been part of the gay sex and party world for a very long time. But by around 2004, the use of crystal meth was so rampant that HIV infection rates began to spike, to the alarm of health officials and those of us who lost so many to AIDS in the 80s and 90s. Gay men on meth shunned the use of condoms in bathhouse environments. Health officials mounted education and treatment campaigns to combat this second epidemic. Now where are we? A new study suggests that meth use may be on a downward trend along with the rate of new HIV infections. They are related. Joining me is the lead author of this new study on the meth epidemic, Henry Raymond, from Dr. Henry Raymond, from the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Welcome to Out in the Bay, Henry.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Matthew Bajeko from the Bay Area Reporter. That's the nation's oldest continuing publication for the LGBT community. Welcome to Out in the Bay, Matthew, again.
Thanks.
Great to have you guys here to talk about this. We're going to explore just exactly the relationship between meth and HIV infection rates and talk about the culture of gay men and drugs a little bit, and then talk a little bit about the economics of the situation as per the news that you wrote about today, Matthew. You've written a lot about AIDS and the meth epidemic over the years. How do you see the arc of this, Matthew?
Well, when I first started working at the Bay Area Reporter in 2001, it definitely was a lead concern of ours, and we would write about it at least monthly, sometimes weekly. If you went out to any of the major gay dance clubs, you know, we used to have weekly parties every Friday, Saturday, into Sunday morning. It was pretty evident that people were doing meth. But then probably around 2005, when Bevin Dufty was elected as the supervisor for the Castro, he made this a big concern citywide. And he was able to get a task force created and more funding and focus from the city and the community onto this. And I think in the last several years now, you definitely don't see it as being talked about as much. I think
you see evidence of it as much because you saw the evidence then.
Well, I think it's gone behind closed doors now. We don't have as a big of a party scene in San Francisco in the gay community.
What happened with that? Do you know why that is? Why don't we have the parties like we used to?
Well, I think nightlife trends change.
Is it generational? Maybe those people are older now and the younger generations are more healthy or something?
I think you've seen a return to kind of the gay bar scene. Certainly it seems to be thriving again in the Castro with new owners, new models of nightlife, and the big dance parties are now kind of monthly. So perhaps if you go out to the monthly clubs and parties, you might see it. But if you talk to people in the nightlife community, they're not really seeing meth as big of an issue as it used to be, 10 years ago.
So part of it's that, you know, the entertainment trend has changed. Instead of going down to South of Market or another far out parts of the city,
right,
it's concentrated more in the Castro. Good for the Castro's economy.
But also just think about drug use. Drug use goes in waves. There's, you know, seems like every decade has a drug that all of a sudden becomes part of the thing to do.
And it was a decade ago that we're talking about. The incidence was so high and so intense.
I mean, with gay men, you know, in the 70s, the stereotype is about popper usage back then.
Poppers,
in the 80s,
Coke.
It was cocaine. You know, in the 90s.
It's always been alcohol. We've always smoked more cigarettes than all of the other populations combined.
Right.
Not combined.
Probably in the 90s, saw, you know, the birth of the ecstasy in the club
raves.
Scene, the raves.
Right.
And then it went to meth. And you just don't see it as much out there anymore. And you know, a lot of gay nightlife stuff, because of social apps, you can be at home alone and connect. So it's not as
you don't have
out
to leave your
public.
House anymore.
Right.
This is the culture. This is the times we're living in.
Right.
Some way, really have to go outside. Yeah. Henry, you're the lead author of this study published in JADES, the Journal of Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndromes, about the trend of HIV among gay men from 2004 to 2011. And Matthew quoted you in his article at the end of February in the Bay Area Reporter as saying that half as many men are using meth in 2011 as they were in 2004. What's the relationship between meth use and HIV infection?
Well, time and time and again, meth use has been shown to be related to unprotected sex, multiple sex partners, and in some cases, directly linked to seroconversion, which means acquiring HIV.
Right.
It has been...
Why is it because of unsafe sex? Unprotected sex is
unprotected
the main...
Loss of inhibition, long periods of sexual activity all at once. That just make people highly susceptible to...
So the numbers make it go up. All those things are statistics.
All those things go up. And it's been focused on as a key driver of new infections, one that the city actually focuses on as something that we watched to see which way it's going to hopefully understand which way new infections will be going.
So you're trying to predict it by anticipating.
It's one of the things we watch. It's one of the things we hope to be acting upon to also reduce new infections.
Well, it was shocking back in 2003, 4, 5. It was shocking when we started hearing about the increase in HIV infection rates. It was so horrifying after all of what a lot of the older people in their 40s and 50s and 60s had been through here in San Francisco back in the 80s and 90s, and we had just been through, we were devastated. Our lives were devastated, our friends are gone. And then to think that, and it was just sort of horrifying. Wow, how can that be happening? And then I heard about the meth, and the meth makes you, there's also barebacking, which is unprotected anal intercourse, and that was, that wearing a condom was looked down on. People would get high, and what condom? No, they're not going to wear a condom. We thought that the young men didn't, because they didn't see the face of AIDS, they didn't see AIDS, that they thought it was just something you could get, but you could manage. Is that something you would agree with?
I think there's so many factors happening at the same time. It's hard to tease them apart. Is it prevention fatigue? People are just tired of using condoms. Is it a specific drug? Or is it... people, like you just said, didn't really think it was a problem. And so many things happen at the same time. It's hard to tease them apart. And that's actually why we look at so many things at the same time, trying to really track what's happening with the epidemic. And I would agree with Matthew that times have changed yet again. And if it's a change in the nightlife or it's a change in economics, people can't afford to be out all weekend anymore. If you're a young person in San Francisco, you can't afford to go party. You have to get up and go to work. There's no free meal ticket anymore. So I think people really have changed their patterns of behavior. I also think that, again, drugs are faddish. They go through cycles. I think there's evidence to suggest that methamphetamine has gone up over the years. You miss Quaaludes from the 70s, right? Those were really popular.
I do. Are you talking to me?
Yeah, sure. Who knows? It can go up and down. We may see it again. I also think, we can look at other drugs as well. So perhaps there is evidence that cocaine use has gone up a little bit while meth has gone down. Maybe people are saying...
Does cocaine have the same problem in terms of seroconversion?
It doesn't. It is something we also track, but it doesn't have the same physiological and psychological effects that methamphetamine has. It's shorter duration of a high.
You have
to do a lot more. It's more expensive. people can't do as much of it.
Today, drugs and gays on Out in the Bay. In fact, you're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guests are Matthew Bajayko from the Bay Area Reporter and Dr. Henry Raymond from the San Francisco Department of Public Health. You can find Matthew at ebar.com and Dr. Raymond at sfdph.org. In your piece on meth and the study in the BAR, you write that Bevan Dufty, Matthew, who's now the homeless czar, he doesn't like that title, but I prefer it, still sees meth use among the homeless at the same rate. So the homeless population is sort of different than what we call, what's the acronym, men who have sex with men, MSM?
MSM.
That's the scientific parlance.
Yeah.
MSMs.
Yeah.
And so but you did cover that in your piece, and I'm just curious what your take on that was in talking to him, because he was the first political leader to initiate some change.
Well, it's a cheap drug, so if you're homeless, you don't have a lot of money, so
and
you're
depressed,
grab it.
And it's so, and you might be mentally ill, and it
definitely changes your outlook on life. So you know, it's a drug that kind of is a siren song in a way. So it's not surprising that Bevin's still seeing meth amongst the city's homeless population. But the other thing I think that he was talking about too is, particularly in the gay male community, men who become addicted to meth, it becomes the driving force of their life. And they don't really, if you become really addicted to meth, it becomes so insidious of a drug that's all you care about. And so he was, I think, also kind of touching upon how it can lead to homelessness. It can lead to people losing their jobs, losing their friends.
Well, addiction in general, you can have
right.
your life fall apart.
And unfortunately, the worst outcome that we've reported on over the years with meth addiction is men who have tried to stop it or understand that they have a problem and just can't stop and turn to committing suicide. And that's a huge issue with wow. meth addiction. And I think once people started to understand the realities of this drug, you started to see a change maybe in the community thinking, whereas, as you were saying at the top of the show, you know, the gay community has kind of accepted drug use as part of our lifestyles, part of going out. But when you start seeing your friends on meth and the problems that it causes,
it's
it changes.
It's a nasty drug.
Your idea of what it is.
You see it in other communities all over the country. I mean, look at the show Breaking Bad in Albuquerque, my hometown, the world's largest truck stop.
Right.
That makes sense. The meth would be there and that all these places that are small towns would be there. What? Yes.
But once things get on HBO, they're not popular anymore in the community once they're on HBO, right? HBO, with all due respect,
it's probably on AMC, but same thing now.
Yeah, but almost. They get around to it after it's the in thing.
Are you just joking with me?
No, I'm kind of joking, but I think it's kind of true. By the time it filters up to the screenwriters and stuff, and they're going to do
the epidemics, and that
you know, it's moved on. You know, it just seems that way.
Tell me about the HIV infection rate, Dr. Raymond. Here, tell me what you're seeing in your study that you did for the JADES, the Journal of AIDS, basically.
So what we're doing at the Department of Public Health is we're doing what's called behavioral surveillance, which sounds really, you know, eggheady, but basically what we're trying to do is monitor the community and looking at things like HIV incidence, the rate of new infections each year, looking at HIV prevalence, the number of people infected overall, and then looking at those things that we in San Francisco call the drivers of infection, which is things like methamphetamine use that we're talking about tonight, STDs, et cetera. And the idea is that if we can monitor this, we can understand which direction the epidemic is heading, and we can do a better job of planning for prevention. And what we're seeing over the past 9 years, I guess it is now, we're seeing some really nice trends. We're seeing that HIV prevalence is stable, which means it doesn't seem like there's a lot of new people getting infected. We're seeing things like...
Yay.
Definitely yay. We're seeing things like treatment coverage rising, which means...
Coverage, what does that mean?
Meaning people who are infected are actually going to their doctors, getting medicines. You know, not...
Instead of 15 or 20 years ago where people were just
exactly
ignoring it.
You know, and in about 2000...
Well, there weren't good treatments 15 or 20
2009, years ago. 2010, the city decided to take a policy that people, as soon as they're diagnosed with HIV, can get treatment. There's no threshold for treatment anymore, which means you don't have to wait until you're a little sicker to get treatment for HIV.
Was there before?
There was.
Wow.
There was.
And well, you're asymptomatic. Don't worry about it.
That's true. Uh-huh. And it's still that way across most of the nation, and it's still that way certainly throughout the world. What we're working on here is kind of a dual thing.
San Francisco always leads the way.
Let's be honest. San Francisco leads the way.
It almost pretty much started here in some way, too.
We really feel like there's a dual thing going on here. If people can get on treatment, that's good for them. But the other benefit is if people are on treatment, they have less copies of the virus in their bloodstream, which means they're less infectious to other people. So there's really this hope that by helping people maintain their own health, it's going to help maintain the health of the community. And so that we call that treatment as prevention. And I think one of the conclusions in the paper that we've been talking about is that maybe we see some sign of treatment as prevention happening.
And this For the first time in 30 years.
And the first time in 30 years, perhaps. And this is a really big topic around the world. I mean, there's been some talk about treatment as prevention. There's been talk of a lot of ways we can use treatment to slow down the epidemic or hopefully stop the epidemic.
Wow.
Yeah.
You see that? Do you see it happening in your lifetime?
Gosh, I would like to see it happen in my lifetime. I think there's always...
It's a glimmer of hope, though, isn't it?
You know, I think we could possibly see it in our lifetime here in San Francisco. We have amazing resources. Hopefully, we continue to have amazing resources. We're not going to see it in our lifetime around the world. There are too many resource-poor places that are just not going to have the same ability to treat people who need it. They're not going to derive that benefit.
And I think, Matthew Pacheco.
I think another part of the picture and a just as large of a reason for the downward trend is gay men and the choices they're making when it comes to having sex and finding their partners. You know, our once again, talk about being on the front end of trends. We were one of the first papers to really kind of focus and talk about serosorting.
We're talking about the Bay Area Reporter, the leading gay paper here in town.
And I did a series of articles several years ago kind of talking about what this means and what it basically is that gay men are deciding, you know, who to have sex, what type of sex, if they're going to use condoms based on if their partner is negative or positive. Mm-hmm. And I think that gay men also in San Francisco know to go, if you're sexually active, that you should be getting tested regularly for STDs and for HIV. If you look at, you know, Magnet, the Gay Men's Health Center in the Castro, they have a line out the door before they even open. They can't, you know,
for what? For testing?
For testing and for treatment.
See, that wasn't the case for
and they're now,
10 years ago.
Right.
Nobody was getting tested, and everyone was ignoring it.
And,
everyone was like, well, it's over. And there was fatigue around it, I know. Yeah.
And the demand is so great for those services that they are now trying to raise $75 million to open a larger health center in the heart of the Castro to have even more testing available for gay men.
Right. Stop on in the hood. I mean, doesn't that make just... It's like, so duh. What good sense that makes, doesn't it? Oh, I have to go downtown? Where do I have to go? Down to South of Market? Really? Do they have a bus down there? I have to take the Muni? I mean, if the people congregate in the Castro, why wouldn't you have those services there?
Well, not only places like the Castro where people congregate, but we're working on different technologies where people can get HIV tests delivered to their home just like Netflix. You know, where people sign up for a subscription. So every 6 months, the CDC or whoever is going to run this is going to send you a little test kit and you mail it back in. Someday, hopefully, we'll have things where people can actually get instant tests.
Right.
I mean, there are new one-minute tests that have been FDA approved, so people could test as many times as they like.
Or without having to send the sample back in some way electronically to just have the results be delivered electronically.
Now, the thing with serosorting that I think is promising but also kind of a worry is that it all depends on how truthful people are in communicating, right? Unless you both get an instant test and stand next to each other and do it and look at each other's
results.
Yeah,
how do people believe each other?
Well, that's a good question. Marilyn, how do we believe anything? You know, it's hard.
Well, most people are just staying in now.
You know,
they're not leaving their homes.
You know, serosorting is in terms of HIV a pretty fail-safe strategy if you're both HIV positive. But if you're HIV negative, it becomes a lot.
Wait,
less...
say that again. If you're both HIV positive,
in terms of
you can't reinfect each other. You can't make your viral loads worse, even if one of you is on drugs and one of you isn't. Or
there is worry about that, but there hasn't been a lot of evidence to suggest that's happened. So in terms of HIV, we're not talking about other STDs and stuff.
I understand.
HIV positive with HIV positive is a pretty efficient strategy.
So they can have unsafe or unprotected sex? You're not going to say that.
I'm not going to say that on air. But I'm going to say in terms of
off the air,
not leading to new HIV infections. That's what I'm saying.
I think what we can say is that is what HIV positive men are choosing to do. And HIV negative men are also choosing to do it to a certain extent, or they're they're having conversations with their sex partners, and it's really easy to do this when you're meeting men online or through social apps, because you can just text someone, you know, oh, hey, are you positive? Are you negative? Well, what are you okay with? Do you use condoms? You know, I mean, you can have those conversations.
Ahead of time,
yeah.
Right. Instead of being high and just things happen. Right.
Yeah. So you kind of...
That's interesting.
But obviously, you know, it's not a panacea. And if you are HIV negative, you still need to be aware and conscious of what you're doing and make you know, decisions for your health.
And HIV negative also depends on how long ago you tested and what sexual behaviors you engaged in, since you said that. So if I said I was HIV negative, your next question should be, well, when was your test? What have you done since you've tested? And, you know, how sure are you that you're still HIV negative? And so it becomes a lot more problematic for negatives to do it, to serosort.
To serosort. That's what it's called, serosort.
Serosorting. Sort yourselves sexually based on your serostatus, your HIV serostatus.
Hmm. New language over the 30 years. That's good. I'm learning. And so, but it is sort of a difficult thing, isn't it, for gay men to sort of figure out who to trust or what to believe. And I'm wondering if they're feeling a little more cautious, if the current zeitgeist of the gay male community, at least here in San Francisco, is a little more cautious, this younger, a little bit newer generation, a little bit...
Okay, I don't think people are more cautious. I think we have a lot more information that people are using to make better educated guesses. You know, in the past, you had very little information to use to make good guesses, and now we have a lot more information out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was Matthew. Also, I think it was also gay men deciding on their own how to come up with a response to what was classified as condom fatigue, where, you know, for the first decade of the AIDS epidemic, it was use condoms, use condoms, use condoms, and then gay men, you know, after the hearing that, they were kind of what they said, condom fatigue. Do I have to use condoms? I don't want to use condoms. Well, this is what one of the strategies that people developed was, you know, serosorting on when to use a condom or not.
I'm learning a lot because, you know, in my experience, I lost so many friends. I would think you just always wear a condom. But apparently that's really not desired if you're a man. That's really...
No, I mean, I think a lot of people would prefer not to use condoms. I mean,
yeah.
Let's just be honest about that.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
I mean, serosorting, there's all sorts of strategies people engage in. People choose to not have sex. There's a certain proportion of gay men who choose to not have sex. There's a proportion of gay men who choose to only have oral sex.
Because they've decided, right.
They've decided that oral sex is as far as they'll take their risk. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone is trying to find the place where they are comfortable with the level of risk. And what we've added to that over the years with technology, with all this information, is people have a wider range of choices of places to be comfortable with what risk they're taking.
And we're here in San Francisco. By the way, you're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guests are Matthew Bajeko from the Bay Area Reporter. You can find him at ebar.com. And Dr. Henry Raymond from the San Francisco Department of Public Health. You can find Henry at SFDPH. San Francisco Department of Public Health.org. Matthew, you wrote a piece today about the financial aspect, some news going on. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, because of a change in how federal HIV and AIDS money is distributed, San Francisco is kind of getting penalized for doing such a good job and bringing down their HIV rates. And what people in Washington decided to do was funnel more money to areas of the country that are seeing more HIV infections. And that means that San Francisco is, you know, on the short end of that funding stream. So
to the tune of just a few million dollars, right?
Last year it was $7 million. This year it's about probably going to be $8 million or so. Mm-hmm. And last year the city was able to backfill that funding reduction with local funds. And this year,
the Twitter money.
This year, they are being asked to pony up again, to the tune of probably about $5 million,
which seems small when you think about the economy and the budget of San Francisco,
right?
The budget of Muni, for that matter,
right? And I think the concern about seeing these services be either reduced, scaled back, or as we've seen, you know, in recent years, agencies have to shut down for a lack of funding, is what Henry's seeing and his trends and what he's saying could be going on with the decrease over the next several years could be brought to a stop, could be reversed. We could see HIV rates go up. I mean, you just, it's hard to tell, but it's certainly a concern and that the city will be focused on over the next several months of how to find that money.
Sure, I bet. Henry, let me ask you, you're the part of the Department of Public Health here in San Francisco. San Francisco is the model. It was the model for AIDS treatment back in the 80s. There have been documentaries, and finally this is getting chronicled a lot more, and so we understand, the world understands more about how San Francisco is, was and has been the leader in and I assume you're the leader now. We're the leader now. You said that earlier. What's it like for you to work at the Department of Public Health in San Francisco and be the lead author of this study for the Journal on AIDS? And in terms of your communication with international AIDS workers?
Well, it's funny you should ask. I spend actually a lot of my time exporting the things we've learned in San Francisco to other countries.
Of course you do. Because we're leading.
Well, I mean, because we're leading, we've developed a lot of things here. We've methodologies and approaches both to surveillance, the type of work I do, epidemiology, to care and treatment, to planning, to policy, and in conjunction with the CDC's Global AIDS Program, we do a lot of work trying to export these best practices to African countries, particularly around the populations that are near and dearest to our hearts and near and dearest to your hearts, Marilyn. Gay and bisexual men. And although the face of HIV/AIDS in Africa has been a lot around women and children, and while that epidemic has been going on, a hidden epidemic has been occurring as well. In some places, like Uganda, where there's a generalized epidemic, there is also a very high epidemic among gay and bisexual men. And for the past 20 years, it's, I guess I would use the word ignored. I mean, it's hard to not say that. And it's coming
or
as
worse.
Coming as a surprise to people that it's there. But I don't think it should have been surprising because those men have always been there. And when the prevention messages are billboards of nice heterosexual couples doing their abstinence, be faithful, or use a condom, the gay guys look at that and say, well,
that's not me.
That's not me. And it's safer for me to have sex with other guys.
Right.
I mean, it's sort of like this reverse.
So I can't get a woman pregnant, right?
Or take China, for instance. I mean, China is really just expanding around the communities of gay and bisexual men really are expanding. And they're partying like it's Donna Summers on the disco and the ball is spinning and they're having a good time. But HIV is still there. They don't need to make the same mistakes.
Well, keep the good work up and keep letting people know in other countries the kinds of things that we're doing here in San Francisco so that we can help the world.
Sure.
Thanks for being here, Henry.
You're welcome.
Matthew, thank you so much for making the effort and coming down here tonight.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it. My guest, Matthew Bajeko, the assistant editor at the BAR, the Bay Area Reporter. You can read his stories at ebar.com. And Dr. Henry Raymond, the lead author of the JADES, or Journal of Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndromes, study we've been discussing. You can find him at sfdph.org. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, a weekly show about gay life from San Francisco. Our show streams and is on the air every Thursday at 7 p.m., and then we archive it for podcasting and on-demand listening at outinthebay.com. It's our brand new website. Check it out. We've put our Playing Favorites page up there. We've got Ang Lee, John Waters, many more. Make a donation. It's tax deductible. Keeps us on the air. Did you hear that? You're the public in public radio. Plus, you can get us on your phone. All you got to do is go to outinthebay.com and download the Stitcher app. Write us with your comments or questions. My email is marilyn@outinthebay.com. Eric Jansen's is eric@outinthebay.com. Thanks to the staff and management of KALW. Joanne Marr is our engineer. Out in the Bay is produced by Eric Jansen and me. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining me.